don't worry, I'm not going to give you a long list of sponsorships and things that you need to buy. Instead, I'm just going to explain. What we do is we teach baking as lifestyle medicine. This is an evidence-based approach to baking, eating, and sharing bread that improves the gut microbiome and mental health. So let's just get straight into this podcast.
I am absolutely delighted to be introducing Miguel Torreo Matias. I'm not going to try a Spanish accent here, who isn't just our resident gut health expert, but he is also a nutritionist and a neuroscientist, as well as one of my expert advisors for my research and what we do here at the Sado School. Miguel's professional interests actually span a wide range of fields in nutrition, in biotechnology, microbiology, neuroscience, and he's been able to kind of bring all these aspects of what he does together whilst he's been working as a research fellow at the School of Applied Sciences at London South Bank University. You're going to tell me if I've got this right so far, Miguel.
Yeah, all good.
So Miguel is the lead investigator in clinical trials looking to further develop our understanding in the relationship between food and gut bacteria and mental well-being. I think it's fair to say that Miguel is very much on the same wavelength as me, is in that it's not just about optimal health, but it's actually in the end, it's about the way that you feel. He's also a member of the Scientific Advisory Board for Atlas Biomed and the principal investigator in a series of patient-reported outcome studies for the British Association for Nutrition and Lifestyle Medicine, otherwise known as BANT. So, Miguel, welcome to the Sado Club. I feel like I need a drum roll for you.
Thank you for having me. And there's another participant as well that you didn't introduce. It's my dog, Quinn, who's watching patiently there as well.
There are studies that show that people who have pet dogs have a wider diversity in their guts. So it's not you know, very relevant to what we're going to be talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I like to think that my diversity must be huge because with two dogs and a cat and surrounded by fields, a little bit like where you are, it's going to have a beneficial impact, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. And probably we're going to tap into that complexity today, that the microbiome is a living thing inside all of us. And it's baffling because it's trillions of microbial cells inside our body, actually communicating with the rest of the body and indeed the nervous system and the brain. And as you can imagine, that amount of different microbes that live inside us, when we try to simplify things to say, oh, dogs might be good, or, you know, living rural might be good, all of those things that we say, is it good or is it bad for the microbiome? There's a certain truth in it, but also it's just too general because everybody is completely different and their microbiome is going to be different as well. So it's a very exciting field because of that complexity. And we keep learning about it.
It's quite interesting that you were talking about when we're coming, I mean, we're going to be talking about mental health and the gut microbiome. What's interesting is that we're talking about what is good and what is bad for the biome. It's not simply, it's not as clear cut as that, is it? Because one of the things that we keep coming back to is balance. We were talking even before this webinar started this afternoon about not being reductionist in it. So it's actually such a broad view that it's about, with teaching my students and the people who are members of the Sado Club, it's about actually understanding it. And that then makes your choices a lot easier to understand what, you know, what we're doing and why we're doing it. So I think that's really important. So Miguel, how important, we've been talking about the gut recently here on the club. First off, how does the gut impact and affect the brain and the way you feel? So that's my first question. And my second question is that In terms of the importance of the gut, how important do you think the gut is? So how does it do it, and then how important is it, or the other way around? What's your feeling on this area?
Well, there's a whole area in neuroscience called health neuroscience, which is relatively new. It's at the interface of psychology and neuroscience, and it has, at a very basic level, three principles, which is, they can be summarized as the brain as the origin of changes in the body, the brain as the receiver or the outcome of those changes from various different places, including the gut, and the brain as a mediator or as a regulator of those changes. So in that field, which again sounds a bit weird, what is health neuroscience? Oh, I've never heard of that before. But Cambridge University and Oxford University, for example, have got a department of health neuroscience. So, you know, the leading universities in the world are picking up on this. It's relatively new, but it's substantial enough to deserve its own kind of that little niche. And there is such a thing as top-down communication from the brain. So the brain is talking to the gut in this case. And there's also a bottom-up communication. And there's a lot more, and this we know from animal studies going back to probably the 40s and the 50s. We know that the cabling that communicates the gut to the brain, and we do talk about the vagus nerve a lot, but there's more to it than just the vagus nerve. But the vagus nerve is an actual cable. So you've got, you know, you've got your brain and, you know, and a cable that goes down to your gut. The vagus nerve actually runs alongside the spine. So it goes all the way up the spine and it innervates all of the gut. So it's tiny little micro cables picking up signals from the gut. That makes up about 80% of the communication between the gut and the brain. So up is about 80%. About 20% will be from the brain down. So from the brain down, it's pretty kind of binary messages, you know, open your bowel, close your bowel, relax the muscle, contract the muscle. There will be, you know, a very black and white kind of messages. The messages that you get from the gut up are a lot more like, you know, cinema in Technicolor, you know, like loads of complexity. So that communication requires not just the vagus nerve, which is very effective at communicating loads of things that are happening in the gut, you know, like you'll have lactobacilli picking up some fiber from your lovely sourdough and eating it and making something in return. So you could almost visualize the lactobacilli as those. I like the emoji that is a little caterpillar. I like those a lot when I'm doing like an Instagram post and I put those caterpillars as to say bugs. Yeah. So I can see those kind of like eating away the little bit of sourdough and then producing something as a result. So it's almost like they're pooping inside your gut. They are giving you, but the poop is good. You know, they are giving you something that is beneficial. And again, they are giving you something that is not just the short chain fatty acids. It's not just the butyrate, because that is a portion of what they do. They are also unlocking a lot of the nutrients that are in a very complex matrix. So when you get a bit of wheat and you grind it and you make sourdough the traditional way, you know, just anybody following you will know what I mean. You've already pre-digested that grain. So you're giving access to your body to things that would be locked anyway if you just bought your regular loaf.
Yeah. At that point, I'm going to come back to that in a minute. So I'm going to stop you, but remind me to come back to the lactobacillus, because I was reading something this morning that will blow your brains out. So carry on.
Okay, cool. And then you've done some pre-digesting. In some other cases, you're not pre-digesting at all. So you might be eating pomegranate seeds, for example. And pomegranate seeds are notorious for being supercharged of nutrients. And there's this thing called ellagic acid. It's incredibly anti-inflammatory and antioxidant, but it's bound in such a way that as a human, you would be left wondering how to make the most out of it. Same things like, you know, ginger and gingerols, or turmeric and curcumin. So you have tiny, tiny amounts of availability of those compounds. Those things called polyphenols or flavonols, so, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And in some cases, it's as low as a 1%. But then your gut bacteria are chomping away at the little bit of turmeric root that you put in your smoothie, or the grain that came in your sourdough, or a little bit of lettuce, or those pomegranate seeds. And they are giving you access to those compounds that go beyond what is the fiber. So the fiber is obviously the macro level. You know, it's something that you can pick up a bit of lettuce and say, right, this is made up of fiber and water, and yeah, you can see it with the naked eye. When it comes to your bowel and the lettuce, it's not a lettuce anymore, it's kind of like, you know, baby food. There's a lot more granularity, a lot of very small molecules, and those bacteria are, yes, indeed, eating that fiber and giving you something beneficial as a result, which tend to be that butyrate or acetate, you know, the short chain fatty acid, these waxy molecules that are very nourishing for the gut. But also they are giving you access to all of these compounds that otherwise would be lost, because humans don't have the ability to break them down. So that facilitates the communication between the gut and the brain a lot, because what we know from recent years is that these molecules that in the past we thought about as being antioxidants, fatty acids, with a very narrow scope of activity. So what does a fatty acid do? Butyrate will nourish the cells in the gut lining. They will use it as a source of energy. Yeah. So the colonocytes, your basically your cells lining the colon, will use that to nourish themselves.
Colonocytes using the butyric acid, yeah.
Yeah, so they basically just eating that butyric acid. So that's a function, but it's doing a lot more things. It's working as a communication molecule. It's bringing messages from the gut to the brain. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with polyphenols. So polyphenols, yes, of course, they dampen down inflammation. They dampen down free radicals. So that's antioxidation. Mm-hmm. But free radicals, again, in the old days, we used to think, oh, damaging molecules, peroxide, things like that. They damage tissue.
Important just to say there's lots and lots of different types of polyphenols. So this isn't like one. So this is why diversity matters, because one polyphenol is different from another, and they actually work slightly differently, antioxidants as well. So for example, one antioxidant like vitamin E will go around by scavenging the free radicals, which actually helps against anti-aging, whereas other polyphenols actually are better at being transformed into molecules or metabolites. So when Miguel is talking about flavonoids and polyphenols, what I see is the diversity blend. So you see, I mean, there's loads and loads of different types. So although it's got a group name, there are, well, I don't even know how many types, Miguel. Do you have any idea how many types?
Oh, polyphenols, hundreds.
Yeah.
Hundreds.
So polyphenols. So when we talk about polyphenols being a precursor for butyrate in the gut, which is protective and is allowing the bacteria to do this, one of the key messages in our seven core principles with Miguel is that diversity is essential to feed the widest variety of these polyphenols possible. So this is quite important in this, isn't it, Miguel? That it's not just
Absolutely.
One thing,
it's a
polyphenol. It's like that these are from, I mean, hundreds of different types of food or polyphenols. So that's really important. So when I first started learning about this, I thought a flavonoid was like one type, one flavonoid or one polyphenol. And you can get different polyphenols and flavonoids all in the same bite, can't you? Does that make sense? Do you want to make a better job of explaining it than me there, Miguel?
Yeah, no. It's, you're absolutely right. And when you combine them, so if you got different polyphenols in just one single food, so you have different polyphenols, for example, in apple or in pear, you don't need to be very sophisticated, or in a bit of chocolate, and then you have that combined with something else, or even just on the same day, because they're still hanging around in your gut. So you blend them at different stages. It's almost like adding an ingredient into baking at a different stage of the process. You incorporate it later. And they basically are all working in synergy. They work much better. So there's a lot of science on the actual availability of these polyphenols increasing when you mix them with other polyphenols. So, and that's very well researched. What interests me the most is the fact that a lot of what happens in that communication between the gut and the brain is regulated at a very basic level by free radicals. So free radicals are generated because we live on oxygen. A lot of our processes are actually based on oxygen, and oxygen oxidates things, as the name says, oxygen.
You can almost see that with an apple, can't you? As it kind of browns, that oxidization, you can see it happening in front of your eyes. And if you kind of get that same kind of thing in your body, the free radicals are damaging. They smash. I mean, I always think of them as being bumper cars that smash around the body, just damaging DNA, bad damaging cells and damaging DNA, and are a precursor to cancer.
But they also are beneficial in the sense that they allow cells to communicate with each other. And it's, again, there will be different types of polyphenols generated at different frequencies and at different places in the body. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a symphony. And then you've got your free radicals. Sorry, so free radicals are generated at different types and in different places. You've got free radicals being generated in the gut. And they, of course, lead to inflammation and damage of tissues, but also to communication. And again, very well researched.
This is quite interesting. So free radicals are not always bad then, Miguel?
Free radicals are necessary. It's just like when you think of oxidation, it's necessary because you wouldn't be able to live if you were not rusting inside all the time, and then anti-rusting. So it goes back almost like a yin and yang. You need both. You wouldn't be just completely antioxidative. You need to be a little bit oxidative. If you go to the micro world that is a cell and you look at the mitochondria, which are the power plants of your body, extracting the energy from fatty acids actually and burning them into sugars and burning them into what is the ATP, which is your energy in your body.
That
happens because it's a nuclear plant. Every mitochondria in your body, trillions of them, is working by the same principle as a nuclear plant. It's basically just extracting energy from using the same mechanism. And that happens by oxidating. Oxidation is the key. So that it happens in every single cell of the body. So then you've got those polyphenols regulating, and you can have a message where I can speak to you in very plain English and I can say, "Hello, Vanessa, you look very good today."
Thank you.
Or I can say, "Oh, hello, Vanessa, don't you look lovely? And wow, the background is amazing." And I give you a lot more, you know, we have a much richer conversation. So the wider the spectrum of polyphenols in your that you feed your bacteria, the wider the spectrum of those compounds you're going to get out of them, that are going to regulate the communication between just free radicals created in the gut that reach the brain. So the messages that reach the brain are a lot finer, a lot more intricate, a lot more sophisticated, and you can communicate things in much more sophisticated. So your brain is going to benefit a lot more of what is going on in the gut and know exactly what is going on in the gut, as opposed to just get very rudimentary, very basic, you know, like you trying to speak Japanese, you know, from a translator, you know, konnichiwa, you know, that's it. You won't be able to say anymore.
Miguel, so kind of stuff. Just translating this into baker's wording, okay? So why diversity of polyphenols? Why diversity of flavonoids? To impact the gut, okay, so this is where sourdough really comes into it. So as it was this morning, I was doing a little bit of background reading, and one of those antioxidants is ferulic acid. And it's kind of the dark brown stuff that you see in the grain. And that is an antioxidant. And it's essentially, its job, it sounds really silly, but you know when the plant's growing, excuse me, is not there sitting there thinking, when I grow up, I want to be sourdough. An organic sourdough made in Vanessa's bakery. That's not what its job is. Its actual job, if you look at the grain, is actually almost like sunscreen. And it's there to protect the plant, the actual growing, emerging, the kernel, from being harmed by the UV rays that it needs. So it's kind of like a double, you know, it's like it needs the sunshine to grow, but it also can damage it. And one of the major things about sourdough that completely blows my brains out is that we have studies, and I'm about to publish this with the ferric acid on Thursday. So guys, if you're listening to this, it will either be on in the website, on there under ferric acid, or it will be available on Thursday, is that the sourdough fermentation gives you between 4 and 5 times more bioavailability of this antioxidant. And what Miguel's talking about is with the diversity, and this is what I find amazing, is that there are 2 or 3 ways in which we've approached our bread here in the diversity blends. And I'll let Miguel tell you a little bit more about that in a second. But in creating diversity within our breads, so baking with rye and barley and spelt and einkorn and korasan, and creating these kind of blends, what you're doing is you're creating all those breadth of polyphenols that are in the bread that Miguel was talking about. And also then you get the flower petals, so the roses and all of these other things that we incorporate in, the cornflowers with the anthocyanins. Green tea is one of the things I often put in that brings you the, you know, flavonoids, cocoa nibs, again, flavonoids, polyphenols you'll see from anything sort of red in there, like hibiscus flowers. So by bringing this into your bread on as part of the flour, by reimagining it, this is hitting what Miguel's talking about in the gut. So providing this mechanism of communicating more clearly, more eloquently, with more elegance between your gut and your brain is diversity. And the sourdough fermentation itself creates what we call more bioavailability, because a lot of the compounds that Miguel's talking about are actually bound up in the cellulose layer. So when the plant's actually growing, if you look at the cellulose layer and you look at the outside of the bran, it's pretty tough going. I mean, you know, it's part of the structure of the plant. So the acidification and the fermentation and the proteolytic activity of those enzymes and the enzymic activity that goes on in the dough is actually pre-digesting it. And in pre-digesting it, once it gets down into the gut, that's when that magic that Miguel's talking about starts, because it's not just there, but it's 4 to 5 times more bioavailable. And that's why when you combine that incredible knowledge that Miguel's just shared, the mechanism by which that gut works, and then you turn it up and go, hey, 4 to 5 times more bioavailability of it, and it's there in the first place through combining your grains, baking and milling a meadow, suddenly, oomph, you've got this incredible understanding of not just how to nourish the gut, but why you nourish it and what that does. So coming back to mental health, because I want to ask you where you get the microbes from in a minute. Just coming back to mental health, Miguel, how does all of this impact? So you touched on impact, on inflammation. How does nourishing these microbes help with mental health? Because this is one of the areas that we're talking about in terms of mental health.
Yeah, so the mental health is a spectrum. Obviously, there's loads of different things. You know, it goes from your classic mood disorder. So you've got your anxiety and your depression, but then it kind of overlaps neurodegeneration as well. So you're going to the Alzheimer's. You know, the Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and so on. And you have neurodevelopmental as well. So I've got ADHD, for example. So that's I haven't got a mental health problem. But when my brain was being made in my mom's womb, the wiring is a bit funky. So, you know, that is overlapping with that as well. And there's indeed some links between diversity and all of those areas of brain health, brain conditions, basically.
That's really interesting, because this morning on the ferric acid, I was reading a study linking reduced association with Alzheimer's from people who had high levels of ferric acid. Isn't that interesting? That's exactly what you just said.
Well, yeah, it is interesting from the point of view that, in a way, going back to an analogy, your mental well-being is like a harmony. So it needs to sound right. You're playing the piano, you're playing an instrument, it needs to sound like the chords are working, you know. So you're going from a C major to an F major, or like, you know, or a G major, you know, and that is a nice melody, you know, the melody needs to work. Yeah. And when the melody is not working, because you just gone the wrong way, or you know, you're learning to play and it sounds like, oh my god, that's really hurt my ears, that's when the brain, there's a bit of wiring in there that's not quite working.
Yeah.
And that can be a wide analogy for all of these situations that we talked about before. Now, putting in those nutrients in the first place that are going to nourish your gut bacteria and create diversity in your gut bacteria is going to enhance that harmony. So it's going to improve your chances of getting your chords right.
So it's a little bit like, I often think of creating recipes. I know it's sounds really stupid, but I do things as a chord. So I have a bass note, a mid note and a high note in terms of flavor. When I think about diversity, I often hear what I'm creating. I don't want to say here, I kind of can sense something almost in an auditory way. It's a kind of weird thing, but I kind of think of it as an orchestra. Like hearing all the instruments are playing and they're all playing at the same time, but you shouldn't really, like a choir. Well, I think I was talking about this earlier with someone about it being a choir and not really kind of hearing one major voice, but hearing all the voices together. It's all, so 120, 130 different kind of things going on in a meal. You know, if you count the component parts of a meal, of a really good diverse meal, it's incredible. The different component parts, you know, is extraordinary, especially when you incorporate into there a bread that is multi-diverse, and a muesli bread. One of the muesli porridge breads with a diversity blend would blow your bread. I mean, we're up to sort of 35, 40 different ingredients in one of those loaves. It's amazing. So,
and Richard is asking in the chat about this diversity. So one a very important thing before I answer or try to answer your question, Richard, is the fact that your microbial diversity, how to impact it, in theory is easy, because it should mimic the diversity of your diet. And this is what has been studied. So if your diet is more diverse, then you are likely to get a more diverse gut flora. It's not always as easy as that or as quick as we want it to be, because we all start on different baselines, and you might be starting from a very low point at which but also have a very receptive microbiome, that the moment that you change something and you have sourdough with a few different ingredients and you have a few more veg and fruit, you shoot up. And some people are very hardy to change. It's almost like a garden that's gone really dry, and for as much as you give it fertilizer and water, it takes maybe 5 years to like come back to life. Yeah. And so, you know, so take all of those things into account. But to make it more practical, Richard is asking about diversity, and he's asking about diversity of fibers as well as flowers. And is it good to change them all the time, or is it okay to have one that is used all the time that has got a lot of diversity? And I get asked this question all the time as well. So I think if you can do a double whammy, so you can do a daily mix that you like that has got loads of things in it, you know, like one of the ones that Vanessa was talking about, the porridge mix, or, you know, one of the botanical blends that they are taking you over 30 ingredients. And at the same time, you can layer things on top. And if you have the reassurance that something as simple as your loaf that you're having some of is giving you a lot of diversity already, you don't need to go overboard on the diversity as well and have, you know, another 30 ingredients every day. But what I normally advise people that I've been working with for, you know, I've been doing stuff with Lloyds around this kind of stuff for a while now. I always say, make it very easy and practical and try to have something that you didn't have yesterday and make it two veg and two fruit and one fruit. So two veg, that normally I say the size of the palm of the hand. So something substantial that you put on your plate that you didn't have yesterday. So if you didn't have broccoli or sweet potato yesterday, those can be those the two veg that you can have. And then you can have one fruit that you didn't have yesterday and try to apply that principle on a 7-day cycle. So every day for 7 days, you have two veg and one fruit that you didn't have the day before, and then you repeat again. And if you do that with your blend and that,
yeah,
your diet is going to be pretty good because you're adding 21 ingredients per week that are new to that week, plus your blend that can have a lot. And of course, you'll have a huge amount of other things that you probably don't take into account, your things that you have as a baseline as well. So if you add everything up, you're easily going 50 plus ingredients every week.
So just putting Richard into play what Miguel's just explained there, next week I think, or the week after, I've got to check my diary, I've got Gil Meller on as a guest, and he's actually very kindly shared two of his soup recipes. One of them has got cannellini bean and it's got chard in, it's got like rainbow chard. And so one of the ways that Miguel's just explained how to do that, so one of the ways I would do that is that I would make a big chunky, there's two or three recipes on the club at the moment. So you've got the curry, the vegetable curry that's on there, and you've got a chickpea curry on there, and you've got various soup recipes, including a cannellini bean soup. So soups are a really good way to change it up different days, to get lots of ingredients in the soup as well. So you've got onions and stock and herbs and vegetables, but then also seasoning. So for lunch, for example, here, one of the things that we do is we create, you know, a meal. By the time you've got your bread, your diversity bread, and then you've got your soup, and then we kind of layer on top with a probiotic, again, coming back to the 7 core principles that we teach here. We would then go in for something like a pickle on top of that. So we might top it out with some sauerkraut, or we might serve it with a little drizzle of kefir on there, or with some cultured butter. So you're layering on top there. So you've got your diversity bread with your wide bioavailability of the minerals. You've got your soup, and then you've got your probiotics on top of that. And again, that increases it. So I would not expect here at the Sourdough School to be eating a meal that had less than 50, a score of 50 on your diversity. And then to be perfectly frank, Miguel will tell you, as part of nourishing your gut, and this approach is about lifestyle. And as much as it might sound a little crazy, I think Miguel will agree with me that nourishing the gut isn't just about what you're eating. It's actually broader than that. And it brings it back to that kind of macro look. I think Miguel will tell you for nothing that walking the dogs when you have your lunch and setting aside, or not your, not, if you don't have dogs, don't worry, just go for a walk or nick a local dog. But just know that it's not just going down to the macro level saying, I've eaten these polyphenols. It's actually broadening it out. Is about the way in which you eat your bread. And then Miguel was talking about that brain with that feedback going that way. If you're stressed out of your brain, Miguel, and you're eating your lunch and you're like, you know, at your computer and you're gurning, what's that doing to your gut?
Well, exactly. That's a very good point. And we did say that it was about 20% of communication that goes down from the brain. But a very important piece to that 20% is the inhibit or stop working. So that very black and white, very binary message, and stress. is the same stress that we have carried for hundreds of thousands of years. That is a very primal emotion. It's telling us that something's going to happen, and that it's probably going to make us have to fight or flight. So hence the name of the fight or flight response. So the brain is saying to the gut, stop working. Because your legs need to get the whole of the energy of the body to get you out of danger, and your arms need to be very active as well in case you need to fight. So the gut is not necessary. The gut is not going to be necessary at the point that you might want to be engaging in a fight or having to run for your life.
So is that why sometimes when you have really high levels of stress, people just get really bad bouts of diarrhea? Because it's almost like, quick, get everything out of me now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that would be the first response. And the second response is you are not going to break down food into the right type of substrate for your gut bacteria to feed on. So you bring your, you know, you're chewing probably too quickly if you're stressed. When you're stressed, you might get more of your carbohydrates because you're secreting more of the enzymes in your mouth that get
more amylase
that breaks down the carbs more easily. So you get the quick release. But then what happens is that things like protein and fats don't get properly digested, and don't forget that, you know, things, protein sounds like meat, but when you have grain, a lot of it is protein as well. So if that is not digested properly, it lands in the small intestine. It's not properly digested as well. It lands in the colon. It starts fermenting and promoting.
So this could be why some people really have bad guts when they can eat bread sometimes and they can't at other times. So what you're explaining here is why people with IBS have these days when they can eat bread and other days they can't. And actually they're blaming FODMAPs, which are fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. Sorry, but that's actually sort of the way the sugars are structured. And it's got nothing to do with that. It's the fact that you're so stressed out that you've missed out on the proteolytic breakdown, and then you're actually pushing them down further because of your stress response, not because of the bread itself that day. Because sometimes people say, I was fine to eat bread today, and another day I couldn't.
Yeah, or the typical thing that happens, that you go on holiday and you can eat bread, and people say, oh, it never happens to me when I'm in Italy.
Or when I'm lying on the sun lounger.
And it might be that, yes, the grain is processed in a different way or whatever, but it at a very, very simple level, it is the fact that you're chilling and you're not eating in front of 100 emails in your inbox. And that is going to allow you to, it's going to allow the gut to do what it needs to do, which is to do its job properly without the brain saying to it, can you stop working? That's which really basically brings about a whole amount of problems.
That's an incredible revelation, Miguel. And I think that's really important. So it's not just about what you're eating. It's not just about the fermentation. It's not just about diversity. But actually, your approach to being able to digest bread and have good mental health is also in the way in which you eat it. So sitting down, having that moment of like, you know, I try really, really hard now to sit and actually, it sounds really strange, but also just a moment of appreciation of the people in my life, of I try really hard to sort of hold on to just a few minutes and almost kind of breathe. And one, it just sounds really strange, and like, this is coming. So I'm going to give you a little secret here. Dan and I are looking at almost kind of like meditation videos for when we're doing the food. And one of the things I want to do is actually kind of like a sort of a video on how you sort of how that you can change your mind, sit and have this tiny little ritual that then impacts the way that your brain is actually working.
I'm gonna show you something.
I'm looking forward to doing this. What, Miguel's off, look. Miguel and I are usually like on like this crazy wavelength where we're really similar to each other. Come on, tell me.
There is also the purpose of meditation, that you basically say, I'm going to meditate.
Yes.
But there's also the connection with something that is very meditative, that doesn't require you to have an app that tells you to meditate, doesn't require you to actually switch, go old school. You know, when I was down with the Buddhists in the, you know, late 90s doing meditation, there was no app, there was no Headspace.
There weren't any apps, were there?
Yeah, exactly. So basically, you know, there's a beautiful little book called Zen in the Art of Archery by Eugene Harrigel, book, which is very, very beautiful. Mm. It was recommended to me while I was doing my yoga teacher training back in 2000. And it takes literally like 20 minutes to read. It's just so small. Mm. But it's about in Japan, how archery is a meditative art. Mm. And you're actually focusing, it's so beautiful because you're focusing on getting to the target, so your mind is laser focused on the target. So it's kind of like a double whammy of why it's appropriate. But when you're baking, your mind is relaxing and it's focusing on the dough, and it's kind of a, you know, it's massaging it and kneading it.
How important it is, Miguel, because you and I are doing we're ready to do our own sourdough, aren't we?
Yeah, I just got my bits together. Uh-huh. I have a revelation that, you know,
I've forgotten.
Yeah, I've got a revelation to confess that I've kind of like tried bits and bobs of sourdough, but I've not started my own sourdough.
Me, aren't you? Under supervision.
So we're going to do
lives.
We're going to do some lives. Yeah. To make my own starter. So watch that space on Instagram.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely. I mean, you're talking to the dough, basically. So because when there are studies,
the hands are telling you what's going on in the dough. So when you are making bread, and that connection is, it's not just this mindful kind of yogic kind of side of it, but actually you have to focus on the dough or you don't understand the bread. So by understanding that communication, we're talking about gut-brain communication, that's your question time starting. It's actually about hands, mind, heart, and then connecting back to the dough to make good bread, to be able to shape it, mix it. That's really part of it. So again,
and bacteria as well, because a study that I'm going to share with you and Vanessa is going to put on the library is about the fact that you can have three people in that same room dealing with the same ingredients. Mm-hmm. And depending on the microbiome that is on your hands, which is again going to be peculiar to you, so you're going to have your own mm-hmm. composition of lactobacilli, bifidobacteria, yeast. Mm-hmm. You're exchanging, you're communicating with those bugs in the actual dough. So when you're kneading it and you're touching it, you're exchanging with the dough. And if you bake it and you analyze it, it will have, those three people will have produced a loaf that has slightly different characteristics. And this has been published as a study. There's more people than just three, but it's a well-known thing that, you know, every baker will carry its own, every person in the world will have their own microbiome. It's supposed to actually make a smell in a different way. And we are attracted to different people because of different bacteria and different yeast on their skin, like those pheromones and so on. Mm-hmm. So that's very, very interesting. And also it's who you do it with as well. So another study that is already in the library and Vanessa is going to point you towards is a beautiful study. I'm very pro-Japanese.
Number 404, this one, isn't it?
And this is about Japanese families have a ritual of bathing together in this kind of a wooden barrel. It's like a you know, rudimentary kind of a bathtub. Mm. And when they are bathing together, they're exchanging microbes. So it's known scientifically that those families that have kept that tradition of doing that, they've got more diversity in their guts than those that have gone to the Western ritual of having, you know, a bathtub with a jacuzzi jet or something, and have replaced the traditional jacuzzi, the traditional bathtub, and the tradition of bathing together. So your mom, your dad, and two, you know, a brother and sister, all in the same, in the same bus stop, having a little chat and kind of, you know, like the Nordics do, the saunas, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And spend the afternoon there. So that kind of thing.
So my best friend is actually in Holland at the moment. She invited me to go to do this when I go over, and I freaked out. I was like, because obviously, you know, her and her partner, in fact, her partner is one of my best friends as well. And she said, yeah, you have to come with us. It is naked. And I was like, no, because I got all English about it. So it's going to take me a little bit to get naked there, Miguel. I might go in with a bathing costume, but
yeah, and I'm not really sure they do it naked.
No, they do. They absolutely no, they do. They're all
right,
I can tell you now for nothing that Arjen and Lucy are out there doing the naked bathing out in Holland at the moment. So anyway, from naked bathing, I knew we'd have to have some nudity here at some point.
This is not my only fans. I'll give you the link later.
I have some questions from club members. So,
yeah.
Okay. Are you ready for our questions?
Sure.
Okay. So we're going to shoot through these. Question received. So this isn't strictly to do with mental health, but I'm going to ask anyway. Howard Corlett, is there a connection between the gut microbes and FODMAP foods?
Yeah, of course, because FODMAPs are fibers that are fermentable, and most people don't have a problem with them. They'll just make you a bit more gassy than, you know, other non-fermentable fibers. But that's all. You haven't got any kind of, you know, discomfort and so on. Some people have a very sensitive bowel, which means that the pressure of the gas and the fermentation is enough to make you feel incredibly uncomfortable. And yeah, the pain receptors that are located around all those nerves that are connecting the gut with the brain are sending super amplified versions of that pain that might be nothing. It may be just a little tap, but for the person with IBS, it just feels like excruciating.
It is.
And that's the problem with IBS, that it's the connection between that cabling in the gut and the brain is sending these very amplified messages about pain and discomfort. And of course, the FODMAPs can be very beneficial for the person without a sensitivity to them and the pain that goes with them, with eating them. With the person who has that sensitivity, again, they all have different thresholds, and some people can eat certain things, they cannot eat another type of things. So it's very individual as to how they react. But in general, there's no need to demonize them. And indeed, if you haven't got a problem with them, you shouldn't be thinking about FODMAPs as anything bad.
Okay, that's brilliant. Howard, I've got two things to add to what Miguel's just said. So the first thing is, when you first start making your bread and you come in wallop with 100% whole grain, don't. Move yourself up a little bit at a time. So start with, if you're used to eating white bread, then start with 90% white and 10% wholemeal. And just slowly, slowly, slowly retrain. What often you see people doing is going, woohoo, I fermented it, therefore it's okay. The level of fermentation, if you have an issue with your gut, is actually important. I would go for a tin loaf. So that's my second piece of advice. My third piece of advice is definitely make it a retarded loaf. So you've got that long, slow, with the acetic acids coming through, that long, slow fermentation, that the acetic acid and that fermentation will help break it down. And then my final, obviously chew extremely well. My final piece of advice is this. When you are fermenting and you're looking at FODMAPs, what you often find is, although people with IBS often will shout, oh, spelt, oh, einkorn, oh, Emma, that's really good. Actually, they have higher levels of some of those sugars that upset you. So when you look at those, sometimes it's not good to go for the heritage grains. It's actually better to go slightly down a more modern grain type than in the first instance, and just gradually introduce those. So that might help you there, Howard. Right, next question. Ready? Are you ready, Miguel?
Mm-hmm.
I think that this is a very personal question from Lucy Bright. She says, given that food can affect the health of our gut and the microbiome, and consequently our mental health, what is your position on the use of antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication and the impact on our guts?
Yeah, interesting. They obviously have an impact, but it's not as negative as to want to replace them with something else. So if it comes to you having to need anti-anxiety medication or antidepressants, of course, everything you put in your mouth will have an impact on your microbiome, but you need to outweigh the benefits. What we do know is that certain probiotics and a lot of the probiotics that are, for example, in your regular yogurt or your kefir, those types of lactobacilli and bifidobacteria, taken along antidepressants, there's been studies done with Prozac, for example, to regulate serotonin. They make the antidepressants work better, so you actually need less dose. So if you are in a position that you need to take those drugs and you find a friendly practitioner that you're working with, either your doctor who is working with your you know, clinical psychologist or psychiatrist who's managing that situation, and they are open to regulating your dose according to you taking a probiotic or to you drinking kefir or eating more sourdough or whatever, and reporting back to them to establish a titration dose that is appropriate for you, that can be very beneficial.
Sophie, I agree with, Lucy, I agree with that completely. My reading, I would recommend Psychobiotics by John Cryan. I think, do you think that's a good book, Miguel, to read? And there's a lot of studies on this in the book, and I've covered this in quite a lot of detail in the new Sweet Sourdough School book. So Miguel is correct. Increase the level of beneficial bacteria, beneficial prebiotics that feed the good guys, so increase your fiber levels, but also increase your probiotics with bifidobacterium lactobacillus, particularly bifidobacterium has been shown to be very beneficial. In other words, back to those seven core principles that we teach, layer into your everyday diet at every given opportunity nourishing, diverse, live microbes that you eat with your bread and with your bake. So go back to the Sweet Sourdough School book. And then if you want to, we'll try and put the book link in here. It's also on the website on recommended books. Right, next question. John Cherokee, to be honest with you, John, you've asked how does sourdough affect the gut? I think, to be fair, Miguel's probably answered that for a lot of this, and so have I. I'm going to briefly cover this one very quickly. Sourdough affects the gut by providing, the way we do it, is more diversity, increasing the nourishment to the gut, more bioavailability of the fiber. We haven't really touched on this too much, but it also damages gluten, so it reduces the gluten load. So, and also there's a little part of sourdough that is acidifying, and the sourdough actually in acidifying slows down the rate of assimilation of carbohydrates slightly and slows down that rate and the transits a little at this part of the digestion. So slows down the rate of assimilation of carbohydrates, which helps control blood sugar. And that is another whole thing that we're going to be coming on into November. So I'm not going to answer the blood sugar too much at the moment. But actually, sourdough itself is not enough for the gut. What you actually need is sourdough diversity, and you need to go back to our seven core principles. And I just finished one of the posts Miguel and I have been working on. I'd be delighted to tell you, John, that you're going to be able to read case studies and see the videos, and where they're out next week. So keep an eye out on this. We're about to release our case studies on our dietary intervention on how sourdough has impacted the gut. I think, Miguel, it's fair to say that we can come back to this a lot because Stefan's is out, and we're going to be able to talk to you about the specific microbes in the gut that changed. That video is just being finished right now and will be out next week. And that's the Stefan Capel on the case studies on sourdough.co.uk. Okay, sorry to jump over that, John. I'm going to ask, so two more quick questions here. Helen Constantinou has asked very quickly, is it pointless to nourish the gut unless you're regularly eating both pre and probiotics?
No, it's always good to nourish the gut. Yeah.
Good. Always good. Right, next question. This is one of my students, Chris Brownlow, and it's a very full question, but he has a very close friend who's just finished a course of chemo for the third time. Now, obviously, Miguel knows I lost a very close friend 3 weeks ago to cancer. So this is very relevant for many people, but he describes him as an alpha male, self-made, successful businessman. Daughter is competing in her third Olympics. He's now in hospital because he's basically incredibly run down. He's got lots of tests and his gut microbiome has been shot to pieces, basically, due to chemotherapy. I think one of the things that it is very difficult is in a sort of broad view, Miguel, looking at how sourdough might help, is there any way that you can help somebody to eat and bake who is extremely, like, you know, really been brought down by, you know, gut microbial diversity? Chemo literally is like, you know, it's poisoning everything. What can you give me three key points that might help this student help his friend to rebuild his gut after this chemotherapy?
Yeah, well, I think the thinking about the botanical blends is very important because you already have a huge amount of diversity built into those.
Mm-hmm.
So those would be my first point of call.
Mm-hmm.
I would make things that are easy on the gut. So a lot of soups and purees and things like that, because if he's been really run down, he might even find it difficult to eat. So
a little bit of vinegar in there.
Pardon?
A little bit of vinegar in a soup sometimes might increases the, yeah. So that's another thing. So is Miguel saying soup's very good, Chris, soup. High antioxidants, so pumpkin soup at this time of year. Think of really big, colourful bowls, but also a little bit of apple cider vinegar in the soup. It's really good for the flavour as well. Sorry to jump in there. Carry on.
No, not at all. And and just think of as many colours as possible. So again, when you're making a soup, when you're making a puree, not just to stick to just one or two ingredients, try to make it as varied as possible. So pumpkin, yes, or butternut squash, yes, or sweet potato, yes. So something starchy that's gonna give it that consistency, but also bring in courgettes and carrots and, you know, just as many different types of fibers and colors as possible, because you're going to need to put in a lot more effort to rebuild that very emaciated microbiome compared to somebody who's working from a better baseline.
Yeah. Chris, my thing that I would say is incorporate sea salt, make sure you have seaweed in there. Seaweed's very good. Bring your nettles into your botanical blends. They build up iron again, as a lot of bioavailable iron is incredibly important. Minerals are very important, but also what I would also say is that layer in probiotics, ferment everything. I won't say ferment the out of everything, but I don't think I should swear on a webinar, but basically ferment. Diversity. And to be fair, although it's very tempting for people to go, oh, do you know what, sod it, I'm going to go and eat junk because, you know, what have I got to lose? Actually avoid the sugar. You know, every bite counts. So think of every mouthful as how nourishing can this mouthful be? I think that's really important. So make every bite count, Chris. And really, to be honest, I'm really happy. If you want to contact me afterwards, I'm very happy to give this chap a Sado Club membership. He can watch this video. If you're watching, then listen to Miguel. He is wise.
and dried herbs as well. Yeah. So dried mixed herbs have very powerful impact on gut bacteria as well. They can make your lactobacilli shoot up as well. So things, you know, getting a nice big bag of your thyme and rosemary and Mediterranean herbs mixed up with, you know, I tend to get mine from a couple of places on Amazon that are just organic, and I get like 1 kilo at the time, and I get marjoram and parsley and I think basil. There's like 5 or 6 in one bag and another 5 or 6 in another bag, and I mix them together. So whenever I add them to a dish, I'm adding a fair amount, not just a little pinch, but you know, a good like a tablespoon, and it's roughage. And of course you've got the polyphenols in there as well. So it's adding a bit of, you know, texture and flavor, and you're adding again, another 10 ingredients to your diet in just one spoonful.
Cool. We've got two last questions, but I'm actually going to skip over these a little quicker because we're almost finished and we're almost out of time. I think we're actually, we're almost there. So Gretchen Millay, she says, whether you've seen any recent studies about the gut microbiome and the relationship to neurodegenerative diseases, for example, Parkinson's, and if so, can you share what you know? Gretchen, I think I'm not going to answer this on here, and I'm not going to ask Miguel to answer it because we're almost out of time, and today's thing really has actually been about mental health. But we are coming back, and these are subjects that we're going to be talking about, and I'm actually going to be talking specifically about this one with Dr. Elizabeth Phillips, who is a neuroscientist who's worked an extensive amount of work with I think it's Oxford. Is Elizabeth Oxford University and King's College? King's College, yeah. Yeah. Elizabeth, I get those right way around. It's Alex's Cambridge, isn't she? And her work on neurodegenerative diseases is off the chart and way more than we can answer in these few seconds. What I will say is look at the fluoric acid. We'll be talking about this later in the week about neurodegenerative diseases and protection. I think it would be fair to say, in a summary of protection from neurodegenerative diseases, the gut is essential. A healthy gut is essential. A dysbiosis in gut, I think you'd agree, Miguel, and low levels of fiber have been associated with Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases. So the bread that you eat on an everyday basis is actually very impactful, and we will be covering this in great detail. The last question here, Dr. Janie Brainer, she says she's wondering about how sourdough bread contributes to the gut microbiome if baking kills all the microbes. And I'm going to tell a little story before I let this one loose to Miguel. Dr. Janie, I always compare this, and I think Miguel will laugh now. If you went into a kitchen and there were 20 chefs in there and they were all making food, right, and the chefs were these live microbes, and one was making soup, and another one was making a lemon meringue pie, and another one was doing roast chicken, and another one was doing, I don't know, think of something good to eat, Miguel, mashed potatoes. If you killed all the chefs, which is a terrible thing to do, the food that they've prepared would still be there. So you'd have 20 dead chefs on the floor, but you'd still be able to tuck into the soup, the lemon meringue pie, the creamed potatoes, because what the microbes are doing is they're doing the work with what you've given to them. The fact that you kill them in the oven actually is, you know, it's a little cruel, you know, I get it. It's not, you know, we've nurtured them and caught them and fed them and spoken to them and stirred them and bubbled them up and said hello, and we've connected to them, and then we kill them. You know, it doesn't seem like a very fair thing to do. But the work that they have done in transforming the flour and starch into longer chain sugars, releasing and giving the bioavailability of the minerals, of creating the acidity that facilitates more bioavailability of the minerals through releasing the enzymes that break down the phenolics that hold on to the minerals. I'm sorry, phytic acid, sorry, it's tired and I'm late, it's late and I'm tired, but basically the phytic acid has actually been neutralized, which allows more bioavailability of the minerals, all of these jobs that they do, and there are hundreds of jobs that they do, the microbes in combination with the enzymes with the flour is done even when you kill it. And I'm just going to say to Miguel this last question, because I think this is kind of interesting. There is also an argument that the dead microbes are beneficial because there are essentially a kind of cannibalistic thing going on. Miguel, can you shed some light on that for me, please?
Well, yeah, they can be eaten by the proteins in the cell lining of the microbes can be digested by the body. And also those same proteins in those membranes are able to create a response from your immune system, which is largely why when we're talking about the benefits of sourdough on immunity in the gut, it's because it will elicit a response from the local immune system. So those dead bodies, particles of those dead bodies are being picked up by receptors in the gut that will, in dendritic cells, largely that are responsible for a lot of the immunity, they will create more mucus as a result. So there's a mucus is a very, it's kind of like the conductor fluid for immunity in the gut lining. So there's a lot to be said for dead bodies of those bacteria coming into the gut. And there were another couple of questions quickly on the chat, actually. Sophie Turrigill, who is a dietitian in the NHS, a senior dietitian in gastroenterology, really interested in sourdough. She's a lovely, lovely girl who's actually doing a master's under my supervision in Middlesex University.
Hi, Sophie.
She's had to go, but she asked that question about kneading the dough with your feet. And would you think of doing that and see what it tastes like? Have you been asked this question before, Vanessa?
Your feet, quite interesting, because obviously there's a lot of stuff going on with your feet. I can tell you a couple of very quick things. The first thing is that in France, in the olden days, and I remember this happening when I was growing up, everybody would jump in and smash up the grapes with their feet. And we all had red feet. And I remember doing it. I was probably one of the last people to do this in the village. It was not very popular. I think we started to get freaked out about the germs and the chickens running around and all that. So I've seen wine smashed up, but very interestingly and very clumsily covered by a baking program a few years ago is historically, and there has been points during history, during the 16th and 17th century, where you will see images of bakers mixing the dough with their feet. And they would jump in because their feet have got strength and they would stand in a big trough and they would kind of really work that mix with their feet. I think that one of the things that I think we evolved with microbes. We evolved eating, let's be fair, we, you know, millennia where we didn't eat stuff out of plastic bags that was sterile. We evolved eating soil and microbes and everything going on. And one of the difficulties is as the Western kind of understanding of bacteria and dirt and things has come on, I actually believe, and Miguel might be correct me at this, that one of the reasons that we have such a high level of immune kind of problems, and I'll include things like asthma, eczema, and hay fever, is because we were coddled away from having the natural world where we would have been allowed to have crawled around. It's only in the past, I would say, possibly 100 years over millennia, where we've suddenly got all clean. And perhaps a little speck of dirt actually wouldn't do much harm. The other thing that I would say is as well, when it comes to bread, is that once you start the sourdough, once you start bringing the pH down within the sourdough starter, for example, the pathogens can't survive. So depending on the level to which you take your pH of your starter, I could mix my starter with my feet. It could have lots of stuff in there, but in the end, the only things that would survive in it at a pH of 4.2 are the things that it's like a private members only club. So I think it's actually part of our evolution was that we evolved crawling around it. I mean, our kids would have been crawling around in the mud. I mean, that's what kids do. They crawl around, they stuff everything in their mouths, an old moldy apple core, whatever they can find. And we perhaps have got a little precious and to our own detriment. Miguel, over to you.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. It's you've answered it beautifully. So there's just a couple of quick questions from Richard. One is easier than the other one. So the easier one first about cholesterol binding to soluble fiber and coming out of the body.
We're going to cover this in its own topic because we're on mental health today. So can I just say to Richard, we've got a whole piece coming up on cholesterol. It's a webinar that will be dedicated to cholesterol. Miguel and I will be talking about that. So that, I don't want to ruin it too much, but if you want to give a quick answer, but we're going to give a good hour on.
No, I'm going to wait then.
You can stay on topic. It helps us not ruin the next webinars. So there, we're doing these regularly, guys.
Yeah, and then the next one is about a connection with the gut microbiome and ADHD or autism. And with both, there are links. And it tends to be in a very, very general way that those people who have had any kind of like funky wiring of their brain whilst either in their womb of their mom or in the early years, they tend to have issues with diversity. And they tend to have issues with diversity that are dictated by the brain. So for as much as you try and build that diversity, you might struggle to get it to other people's levels. And that's quite well studied. It doesn't mean that you cannot benefit from diversity. And in fact, you do. So again, there's that kind of like balance between what the brain is dictating and what you can do to improve the diversity in the gut. But I'll probably leave it as that because it's quite a complex issue. But I'll probably be writing about this as well, Richard, if you follow me on Instagram, because I've only been recently diagnosed, although I think I've known all my life because I was already taken to the school psychologist. I'm 47 as well. So this ADHD, like there was not ADHD when I was like 7 or 8, you know, nobody knew about this kind of stuff. It was just like, oh, a naughty child. But I remember being taken to the school psychologist back in the day, you know, when I was 8 or something.
We were naughty by then, Miguel.
I was naughty. Yeah, because I was naughty. And the school psychologist said to my mom, there's nothing wrong with your child. It's just that, you know, it's just a bit hyper. So, you know, 47 years on, you know, like, you know, 40 years on, and I'm still, I'm not as hyper physically, but I'm quite hyper in my head. So yeah, I've come out recently as ADHD full on, wanting to share things with the world. So I'm pretty sure I'll be writing about it.
On this, it would be cool. Yeah. Miguel, thank you very, very much for being such a fantastic guest tonight. It's actually been amazing. I've learned even more, which I find fantastic. Chaps, if you're watching this and you look below on when we put this up, we will be putting on here any references, any books that we've got in here, and you can watch this at a later date. Miguel, thank you, my love. Thank you very much for everyone for participating.
Thank you, everybody. You're great. See you soon. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.
I really hope you've enjoyed listening to this. If the idea of prescribing baking as lifestyle medicine as an evidence-based approach to your patients to help them improve their physical and mental health through the bread that they bake, eat and share every day appeals to you, then go to thesourdoughschool.com and learn how you can prescribe or teach this as part of your own practice. If you have just fallen in love with the whole concept and you just want to learn to do this for yourself and your family, you can self-prescribe at thesourdoughclub.com. I look forward to seeing you in some of our live sessions. don't worry, I'm not going to give you a long list of sponsorships and things that you need to buy. Instead, I'm just going to explain. What we do is we teach baking as lifestyle medicine. This is an evidence-based approach to baking, eating, and sharing bread that improves the gut microbiome and mental health. So let's just get straight into this podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I like to think that my diversity must be huge because with two dogs and a cat and surrounded by fields, a little bit like where you are, it's going to have a beneficial impact. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. And probably we're going to tap into that complexity today, that the microbiome is a living thing inside all of us. And it's baffling because it's trillions of microbial cells inside our body actually communicating with the rest of the body and indeed the nervous system and the brain. And as you can imagine, that amount of different microbes that live inside us, when we try to simplify things to say, oh, dogs might be good, or you know, living rural might be good, all of those things that we say, is it good or is it bad for the microbiome? There's a certain truth in it, but also it's just too general because everybody is completely different and their microbiome is going to be different as well. So it's a very exciting field because of that complexity, and we keep learning about it.
It's quite interesting that you were talking about when we're coming, I mean, we're going to be talking about mental health and the gut microbiome. What's interesting is that we're talking about what is good and what is bad for the biome. It's not simply, it's not as clear cut as that, is it? Because one of the things that we keep coming back to is balance. And we were talking even before this webinar started this afternoon about not being reductionist in it. So it's actually such a broad view that it's about, with teaching my students and the people who are members of the SADO Club, it's about actually understanding it. And that then makes your choices a lot easier to understand what, you know, what we're doing and why we're doing it. So I think that's really important. So Miguel, how important, we've been talking about the gut recently here on the club. First off, how does the gut impact and affect the brain and the way you feel? So that's my first question. And my second question is that in terms of the importance of the gut, how important do you think the gut is? So how does it do it? And then how important is it, or the other way around? What's your feeling on this area?
Well, there's a whole area in neuroscience called health neuroscience, which is relatively new. It's at the interface of psychology and neuroscience, and it has, at a very basic level, three principles, which is, they can be summarized as the brain as the origin of changes in the body. The brain as the receiver or the outcome of those changes from various different places, including the gut, and the brain as a mediator or as a regulator of those changes. So in that field, which again sounds a bit weird, what is health neuroscience? Oh, I've never heard of that before. But Cambridge University and Oxford University, for example, have got a department of health neuroscience. So, you know, the leading universities in the world are picking up on this. It's relatively new, but it's substantial enough to deserve its own kind of that little niche. And there is such a thing as top-down communication from the brain. So the brain is talking to the gut in this case. And there's also a bottom-up communication. And there's a lot more, and this we know from animal studies going back to probably the 40s and the 50s. We know that the cabling that communicates the gut to the brain, and we do talk about the vagus nerve a lot, but there's more to it than just the vagus nerve. But the vagus nerve is an actual cable. So you've got, you know, you've got your brain and, you know, and a cable that goes down to your gut. The vagus nerve actually runs alongside the spine. So it goes all the way up the spine and it innervates all of the gut. So it's tiny little micro cables picking up signals from the gut. That makes up about 80% of the communication between the gut and the brain. So up is about 80%. About 20% will be from the brain down. So from the brain down, it's pretty kind of binary messages, you know, open your bowel, close your bowel, relax the muscle, contract the muscle. There will be, you know, a very black and white kind of messages. The messages that you get from the gut up are a lot more like, you know, cinema in Technicolor, you know, like loads of complexity. So that communication requires not just the vagus nerve, which is very effective at communicating loads of things that are happening in the gut, you know, like you'll have lactobacilli picking up some fiber from your lovely sourdough and eating it and making something in return. So you could almost visualize the lactobacilli as those. I like the emoji that is a little caterpillar. I like those a lot when I'm doing like an Instagram post and I put those caterpillars as to say bugs. Yeah. So I can see those kind of like eating away the little bit of sourdough and then producing something as a result. So it's almost like they are pooping inside your gut. They are giving you, but the poop is good. You know, they are giving you something that is beneficial. And again, they are giving you something that it's not just the short chain fatty acids. It's not just the butyrate, because that is a portion of what they do. They are also unlocking a lot of the nutrients that are in a very complex matrix. So when you get a bit of wheat and you grind it and you make sourdough the traditional way, you know, just anybody following you will know what I mean. You've already pre-digested that grain. So you're giving access to your body to things that would be locked anyway if you just want your regular loaf.
Yeah. At that point, I'm going to come back to that in a minute. So I'm going to stop you, but remind me to come back to the lactobacillus, because I was reading something this morning that will blow your brains out. So carry on.
Okay. Cool.
I really hope you've enjoyed listening to this. If the idea of prescribing baking as lifestyle medicine as an evidence-based approach to your patients to help them improve their physical and mental health through the bread that they bake, eat and share every day appeals to you, then go to thesourdoughschool.com and learn how you can prescribe or teach this as part of your own practice. If you have just fallen in love with the whole concept and you just want to learn to do this for yourself and your family, you can self-prescribe at thesourdoughclub.com. I look forward to seeing you in some of our live sessions.